Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
This is Ozarks at Large. That was President Franklin D. Roosevelt. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. When Randy's here, we're talking about things in Arkansas history. No different today.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, that declaration of war with Japan triggered something of significance here in Arkansas.
Sure did.
And I came across something just the other day in the archives from a 1967 report in Roar, Arkansas. Now, the significance there is, immediately after the declaration of war, the United States government started rounding up thousands and thousands of Japanese Americans. And these were American citizens.
Some of them third-generation American citizens.
Yes, and of Japanese descent. There was such a scare that there was going to be an invasion of the West Coast because of its proximity to Hawaii. And they started rounding these people up as enemies of the United States and taking them to, as they called them, relocation camps or
internment
centers. Oh. They were relocation centers, as they were called. But they were, the way that it's been described, they were more like concentration
camps.
There were 10 of them across the country. They were all inland. They were landlocked states, and two of them were in South Arkansas.
And these were the only two that I think were west of Colorado.
Yes. Yeah, we were the furthest east.
East, yes.
Yes.
East of Colorado, right.
And so I found a Jim Pitcock news report from 1967 when he traveled to Roar, and all that was left of this camp was a grown-over cemetery with a couple of monuments but quite a few tombstones. And so this is the beginning of Jim Pitcock's report.
This cemetery represents an unfortunate period in U.S. history. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, more than 17,000 Japanese were moved here from California because Japanese underground activity was feared during the war. Many of the Japanese were brought to Arkansas to live at this camp at Roar, which is located about 14 miles north of McGee. A second camp was located at Jerome, south of Dermot. 7,000 Japanese were relocated there. One man that remembers that period well is C.C. Stewart, superintendent of Deschutes County Schools.
Many of the Japanese were bitter because they were taken out of their occupation. But however, most of them understood, especially the children, that it was necessary. Some of the older persons never believed that it was right. But most of them believed that it was right to come to a place like that for their own protection as much as for the protection against an invasion in California.
This fellow, C.C. Stewart, that Jim Pitcock talked to, I'm sure there are few, if any, living down there that would remember that. Now, someone who does remember this C.C. Stewart was a resident. He was a, white Arkansan who was living in the area.
Right.
And he's going to be describing the camp. But we talked to the Pryor Center a couple of years ago, talked to George Takei, who you would know as Mr. Sulu, most famously from the original Star Trek series. But he, he's an actor, he's an advocate, and an activist. And he's very involved with this movement because when he was 5 years old, he was scooped up. He lived in California with his family. I believe his family owned a dry cleaning business and were doing quite well. And then this happened.
That's one morning I'll never forget. My parents got us up very early that morning. my brother Henry, who was a year younger, and my baby sister, who was a baby then.
We need her name.
Oh, Nancy Rako.
Rako.
Yes.
Okay.
And my brother and I were in the living room looking out the front window, and we saw two soldiers marching up our driveway. And I remember the flashing, the sunlight flashing on their bayonets. They stomped up.
They had bayonets on.
They had bayonets on. And they stomped at the front porch, banged on the door. My father answered it. And literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father had small pieces of luggage for my brother and me to carry. And we went out and we stood on the driveway waiting for my mother to come out. And when she finally emerged from the house, she had the baby in one arm, a great big huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheek. It was a terrifying morning for us, for me. And we were put on a truck with other Japanese American families that they had gathered. And they took us to Santa Anita Racetrack.
And much of this account is related in words, not in video or audio like the Pryor Center has, but in words at the museum that's in McGee.
Yes.
That is dedicated to Jerome and Rohr.
Yes.
And the people who were.
And he was actually there for the opening of the museum. But they, you know, they're open Monday through Friday, and
it's worth your time. It really is. It's well done, and from my perspective, somewhat unflinching. I mean, it doesn't try to gloss over.
Right, right. They're if you go to their website, you know, they're very frank in their description of the camp. Now, let's go back to this gentleman, C.C. Stewart, who describes how he remembers the living conditions of the camps.
Well, did they have their own community, or did they just sort of fit in with the other people who were living in this community?
No, it was an isolated community. They had their own schools. It was divided up into blocks and areas, and they had a regular city government and a school system. They were very artistic people, and they also brought to the people here the idea of irrigation and vegetable growing, and they were great gardeners.
Now, someone who was there, who lived there, right? And we're going to go back to...
Yes, we're going to go back to George Takei, and he's going to describe as a child what he saw living there.
They were barracks, army barracks with tar paper covering, and... they were arranged in very military style, and the mess hall was in the middle. It was a block like this, and about a dozen barracks all in a row. And in the middle of the block was the mess hall, the laundry room, and the shower. We all, you know, had to make that trek to the... mess hall three times a day. There was a iron triangle by the entrance to the and that would summon us for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But when it rained, the whole camp turned into a swamp, a muck, and elderly people couldn't make that trek to the mess hall. Their feet would sink in, and they didn't have the strength to pull their feet out of the muck. Or mothers with young children, you know, had enormous difficulty. So my father organized a group of young men to build boardwalks connecting every one of the barracks to the mess hall and the latrine, essential places that we had to go to.
I'm talking with Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. We're, again, this Monday, going into archives from the Pryor Center today about the concentration camps at Rohr and Jerome.
Well, and it was, in fact, you know, not a relocation center, but like you said, a concentration camp. It was 500 acres in swampy South Arkansas land surrounded by barbed wire, and they had armed guards and towers all around. So, yeah, this was no center or people to have refuge.
Right. Center or camp makes you think that you could, you know, leave and go to town.
Right.
You could not do that.
Oh, no. They were confined.
Yes.
And as he said, it was an isolated community. Well, it was isolated by armed guards and barbed wire.
Right.
So, you know, we have the different perspectives of a local resident speaking in 1967 and George Takei speaking a few years ago. Well, we'll go back to C.C. Stewart as he talks about the children who George Takei would have been one of them.
I believe that many of the children, I have a lot of their materials, their poems and things like that, and pictures that they drew. And they were very patriotic in the school, and they tried to lean over backwards to show that the people that they were good Americans. But these children were scared of the lightning, they were scared of the snakes, and it was just a raw country to them, and it made a very high impression upon them, and they wrote those in their little plays and in their little poems. Some were very good poems also.
And George Takei actually spent his kindergarten years at Santa Anita Speedway awaiting to be deported or shipped out to the camp, and his family lived in a horse stall, and he had his kindergarten year there and then was sent to Roar. So here is George Takei's take on living there as a child.
And thank God we were as young as we were and not really experiencing the pain, the anguish. And, you know, my parents had to deal with that loyalty questionnaire. You know, it was torturous for them. And we were saved that as children.
Now, we've heard from C.C. Stewart, we've heard from George Takei. One thing we can't hear because we just don't have access, I'm imagining, is, and they do talk about this at the museum, there were also poor African Americans who lived in this part of the state, poor and really were still smack dab in Jim Crow. And so the museum tries to make this juxtaposition. The people who are in the concentration camps who've had their homes and businesses taken from them, but they're getting meals. And there's this quote from a poor African American who's living in southern Arkansas who doesn't have enough to eat many days, but is, quote, free. And it's like, it's multi-layered.
Right.
And they were, he recounts being somewhat jealous of the people behind the barbed wire because he had heard that they had good meals three times a day, which he could not afford for his family. So
Now, in this last interview we heard, there was this question of loyalty that his parents had to sign. And this was a crazy thing. We talked to George Takei about this pledge, and it was sort of a catch-22 that all citizens had to sign.
And this is a bit longer of a piece cut than we usually have.
Yes.
But it's worth every second of your time.
And there's this other amazing story. Young Japanese Americans, immediately after Pearl Harbor, like all young Americans, rushed to their recruitment centers to volunteer to fight for this country. That act of patriotism was answered with a slap in the face. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy non-aliens. I mean, it's outrageous to call people who are volunteering to fight for the country, possibly die for the country, for your country, to call them an enemy. It was outrageous. But that outrage was compounded by the word non-alien. What does that mean? Non-alien. That's a citizen defined in the negative. They even took the word citizen away from us and locked up for a year. But then After a year, the government realized there's a wartime manpower shortage. And here are all these young people that we've called enemy non-aliens. How do we tap them? And so they came down with another outrage, a loyalty questionnaire. A loyalty questionnaire after they've taken everything from us. My father used to say they took my business, they took our home, they took our freedom. And they now want you to sign a loyalty questionnaire. It was a series of questions, but there was one stupid, sloppily put together question that was outrageous. One sentence with two opposite ideas. It essentially asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? This being asked of an American citizen. For the government to assume that there is an existing inborn genetic loyalty to the emperor simply because we look like this was outrageous and insulting. And so if you answered, no, I don't have a loyalty to the emperor to forswear, you were also saying no to the first part of the same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America? If you answered yes, meaning I do swear my loyalty to the United States of America, you were then fessing up that you had been loyal to the emperor, and now we're willing to set that aside and pledge your loyalty to the United States. It was a no-win question. And the amazing thing is thousands of young Japanese American men and women answered yes to that question and went from behind those barbed wire fences, leaving their family in imprisonment to fight for this country. They were put into a segregated, all-Japanese-American unit and sent to the battlefields of Europe. And they fought with astounding courage and valor. They sustained the highest combat casualty rate of any unit of its size proportionally. And when the war ended, they came back the single most decorated unit of the entire war. It's an amazing story. But there's another stinging irony to this story. Those that perished on those bloody battlefields and had their coffins covered with the American flag, those flags were brought back to their wives or their parents still behind American barbed wire fences. Can you imagine grieving over the loss of your husband or your son, and then to be brought this flag that they died for, that's also keeping you in imprisonment?
And to think that, you know, after all of that, there were still young men who went and fought.
Yeah.
And you could tell when we talked to George Takei, he got very emotional. But, you know, over the years, it eventually went away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at first there was very high security because they didn't know what to expect. The U.S. government, you know, they really believed that, you know, these normal U.S. citizens were of some sort of threat. But then, you know, over time they realized that no, and so security became more and more lax over the years. And by the end, there was only one officer and 13 guards at this camp, which with that many people is not very much. So finally, it was proposed that all of the relocation centers be closed. And then finally, on November 30th, ROAR officially closed. And the Takei family went back home with nothing and to nothing. Mm-hmm. Their bank accounts had been cleaned out. Their home.
Their business.
Their business was gone. Everything was gone. And they even, they had no place to live, so they lived on Skid Row. You've heard of Skid Row in L.A. They lived on Skid Row for 5 years. And he finally worked his way to where he is now. He studied first architecture, but he went to UC Berkeley, went to UCLA, and studied Shakespeare at Stratford-upon-Avon uh-huh. and became a well-known actor. And now he's involved not only with LGBTQ,
right, yeah.
Issues, but also with the Japanese-American movement. So he came back and helped dedicate the center at Rohr and walked out among the what was left of the cemetery and a couple of monuments that had been built. But he was really moved, obviously, and this is how he describes his emotions.
It was very moving, but the most prominent marker there was a crumbling concrete pylon. It was old and it was starting to crumble away. And at the base of it were the names of all the young men who went from Rohr and fought with the 442nd and perished. And standing there reading those names, just thinking about it, I'm kind of losing it, but they're those incredible, crazy young men who went from that camp and fought and died for this country. They were the greatest generation, and these young men whose names are there on the base of that monument were extraordinarily, uncommonly great. They made my America possible.
It's a story that, I don't know, maybe now in school you learn about it if you go to school in Arkansas. I certainly didn't.
And
it wasn't
either.
Until I was in college.
Right.
And it was hard to believe that this had happened.
Right.
And like you say,
I mean, I think
the businesses
I was at
were
KATV
taken.
Before yeah. I really knew a lot about what had happened.
Yeah. So, and the museum is in downtown McGee.
Yes.
And I think it's $5 or $10 cash to get in.
Five.
Mm-hmm. It's not that big, but they pack a lot of information in.
Mm-hmm.
And
I believe educational groups
yes,
are free.
Absolutely.
Yes, and children are free.
Well— And don't do this, people. But when I went, I didn't have any cash. You know, it's 2021. I thought I was going to pay with a debit card. And they waved me in. They said, okay, go ahead. You know. The woman that was there said, it's more important that you see this museum than – so I need to send them $10 to cover. Yeah. But it's well worth your time. And you got to get off the – it's not an interstate, but you got to get off the four-lane highway and
right.
go to downtown McGee
right.
to do it. This also highlights something that we do because we do the KATV archives, but there's so much more at Pryor Center, these long-form interviews.
Which George Takei is a
right.
perfect example. We he was in Hot Springs for the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival several years ago to debut his documentary,
yeah.
It's Okay to Be Takei.
Yeah.
And we sat down with him for about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And that's mainly what we talked to him about is his time in Arkansas and his returns.
And that interview and so many others are at the website.
Yes, Arkansas Memories section, and then there's a KATV section. So we have several projects on there that include audio, video, and all kinds of interesting, fun
yeah.
things.
Things you need to know.
Yeah.
Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, thanks so much.
Enjoyed it. I'll be back next week. You want to try a time capsule?
You mean from a certain time?
Yeah, month and year.
Sure.
I'll just pick one at random.
Throw the dart at
okay.
the board and we'll
I'll
see
do
what
it.
We got. All right.